Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. This is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. More than 50 years ago, Dr. Sonny Harford III walked his 6-year-old son to school. While this action may seem ordinary, it was anything but. Sonny Harford IV was about to become the first African-American student to go to an all-white public school in Alabama. Dr. Harford worked hard to desegregate Alabama's schools, and it wasn't easy. He's here today to talk about the civil rights era and share his thoughts on modern-day social justice efforts. Dr. Harford is this year's keynote speaker at UW-La Crosse's Reflections of Ebony celebration. Leading up to that moment when your son, Sonny IV, became the first African-American student at the Fifth Avenue School in Huntsville, Alabama, why was it that you wanted Sonny IV to go to an all-white school?
Well, I guess I'll have to go back and tell you about how it was when I went to school. First of all, my home was 6 miles from the school that I attended. And there were school buses. They had city school buses, but blacks could not ride the school buses. So I had to walk to school. Rain, sleet, snow, I still had to walk. The next thing is that my school was located right in the midst of the city dump. It surrounded my school on 3 sides, like a horseshoe. Matter of fact, I call it the horseshoe phenomenon. And we didn't have air conditioning, so we had to have the windows up. So imagine being in the school in early September or late May, and they burning trash out there at the trash pile. That's the way it was. And I saw in the health book where it said we should get plenty of fresh air. I wanted to be a physician.
When did you decide that you wanted to become a physician?
I was about 11 or 12 years old. We had no library in the school, and I was not permitted to use the public library, even though they took our tax money to build the library. We had no gymnasium in the school, no lunchroom, no playground, no chemistry lab, no physics lab, no biology lab. And I thought that would have been worthwhile for a person who wants to be a physician. And so the schools were, as they put it, separate but equal. They maintained
that
separate part, but they did not come up to par on the equal. So I thought the only way that we could really have equality was to have the kids to go to the same school. So Brown versus Board had been decided by the Supreme Court in 1954. And my son was born in 57, and now he's getting ready to go to school at 63, and our schools were still segregated, and nobody seemed to make any move to do anything about it. So we found out that the NAACP would assist us in filing the suit. And so I went ahead, and in the spring of, in the fall of 62, we had a desegregation committee in the city, and we went around getting names on a petition from the black citizens asking them to petition the school board to integrate the schools. And we were able to get 35 signatures of 35 families that were interested in having the schools desegregated. And we passed this on to the school board. As a matter of fact, we had several meetings with the school board and expressed our desire to have the schools integrated. But their response was always negative. So then in the spring of 63, we decided to go ahead and file suit.
And was education always one of the main goals, or with that desegregation committee, were you also looking at integrating within different businesses within the community too? And
yes,
bathrooms.
We were going across the board. We wanted to integrate the eating facilities, the hotel and motels. We wanted to have job opportunities. We wanted equal pay, back in those days, it definitely was not equal pay. Sometimes there were cases where minority people would be working at the same companies where the white people were working, and they were making sometimes twice as much doing the same job. So we wanted to see if we could do something about that. There was a problem about housing. Minorities lived on one side of town, and the other people lived on the other side of town, and the real estate people sometimes would not even show a house to a minority person in certain areas in the city. So we were trying to get across the board desegregation.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Sonny Herford III, a civil rights activist who worked to desegregate the schools in Alabama. Before that moment when your son entered those school doors, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to visit and met with some of you.
Yes, Dr. King came March 19th, 1962, and spoke to us. And we asked Dr. King to come and speak because our movement was losing momentum. And we wanted him to come and see if he could give us a shot in the arm. Sure enough, he did that. And after Dr. King left, our people were energized, and more people joined the movement, and even some Caucasian people join in with us. Prior to Dr. King's arrival, there were only three or four Caucasian people who were actually participating in our movement.
What were some of the actions that you all would take in order to get your message across or just re-energize the base?
We decided that we should start off low-key. We didn't want to go in with a lot of trumpets blowing and guitars playing and searchlights in the air and all that business, you know. We started off low-key. What happened with our movement, it was the first Wednesday in January 1962, a field agent from CORE, you heard of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality,
okay,
came to Huntsville and went into the high school there. We had one high school for blacks, and came into the University of Alabama A&M, and he enlisted some students to go and sit in with him. So he took these students down to the restaurant, and for instance, if the restaurant tour had 13 stools, he'd take 13, 14 students down there, and they'd each go and sit on a stool. And they were saying, basically, I suspect you're not going to serve me, but you're not going to serve anybody else on this stool on this day. And some of the students would actually sit in a whole day. But then the city found that they had, the city officials, that they had an old law on the books, a vagrancy law, whereby the proprietor could come by and tell the students, adults or whomever, that I don't want you in my business. I want you to leave right now. And it was called trespass after a warning. And if you did not leave, then he would call the policeman, and they would come in, and he would sign a warrant, and they would put you in jail. And it was a $100 fine, which is like $1,000 or $1,100 now, and 6 months hard labor. Six months in jail. Hard labor is what the mandate was, although I never knew anybody to actually go to the rock pile. But they had to spend 6 months in jail if you did not bail them out. And so we bailed the kids out, and some of them were arrested two and three times in one day.
Wow.
So we had over 600 arrests.
And there was also, I think I've seen some footage of picketing, in a sense, at least walking up and down the streets with signs.
The so then we did, as I said, low-key, it was sit-in. Then we did picketing. You know, well, they couldn't arrest you for picketing. That's First Amendment. If they did arrest you, you know, they couldn't hold you because this is the First Amendment. You can't arrest a person for freedom of speech. So they didn't even attempt to arrest anybody for picketing. And so then our third move, since it appeared that we weren't getting what we wanted with the Loki, we decided to take it a step further, and we decided to have a boycott. And so we thought this would really get their attention. If you look on the calendar, you'll see that you have 3 bonanza selling seasons for stores. That's Christmas, Easter, and back to school. And they are approximately 4 months apart. So there's no time in the year that you could start a boycott when you wouldn't be approaching one of these situations, you see. So our movement started in January, and we are coming up to Easter. And back in those days, all of the black people in my community, everybody wanted a suit or a new dress or some new outfit, you know, and they were paying roughly about $100 for these outfits. And we decided, well, this time we're not going to buy that stuff for Easter. We decided we're going to wear blue jeans for Easter, and we're not going to buy them in Huntsville.
Wow.
We didn't even want them to get the $2.50 or the $5 for the blue jeans. So we bought them in adjacent cities, you see. Now, our boycott was successful beyond our wildest dreams. We learned later that we had at least 5 groups of people that were not shopping, and some of them we did not know about. Well, first of all, you had about 95% of the people in the black population, and this was about 1/5 of the city population, about 95% of those people just did not buy anything. Not only the clothing, they didn't buy any furniture, any toys, or anything. Then we had some white people who belonged to labor unions and didn't cross our picket line. We were not aware that this was going to happen. Then we had some white people who didn't come downtown. We didn't have any shopping centers. All of the activity was downtown. And some white people didn't come downtown to shop because they didn't want to be in a commotion down there. All these people down there demonstrating and picketing and all that, and they just didn't want to be involved with that. Then we had some white people who came downtown to cheer us and egg us on. Then we had some white people who came downtown to taunt us and jeer us. And none of these people were shopping. Even the ones who were against the movement, they weren't shopping. They were out there taunting us, you see. And so we estimate that the merchants lost over $1 million.
Wow. $1 million in 19.
By today's standard, we were talking about 11, 12 million.
Wow.
You see? That got their attention. But you don't tell the merchant, if you don't hire some black clerks by May 15th, we're going to boycott you. We don't tell him that. We let him, as he's approaching Easter, let him go to the bank and borrow money and stock his shelves and his racks. And then we don't go in to buy. And then as he approaches this holiday, he walks up and down the aisle and he looks over there and he sees all of these goods over there. And he can't turn it into money. And he's not going to be able to repay that money to the bank.
So were the different stores and business owners, were they quick to turn and realize that integration was necessary?
It soon caught on. And then, too, we had asked the mayor. We had some informal sessions with the mayor and the city council, and we also attended the formal meetings. And we had asked them to form a biracial committee of some black people and some white people. And we didn't care how many people were on the committee, and we didn't care what the makeup of the committee was, but just get somebody that looked like they're working to try to solve these problems that we're having here. And so he finally, after the sit-ins and the boycott and all that business, did establish this biracial committee, and they started working and speaking with the merchants. And after the merchants saw that they were losing money, then they decided to go ahead and have what they call a trial integration. So on July 9, 10, and 11, they had a trial integration whereby 6 lunch counters had agreed to allow the minority people to come in at a certain time, just two initially, only two persons, and get a sandwich or a drink or something like that, you see. And by this time, the city had agreed to cooperate with us, and they even sent some plainclothes men to these restaurants and these lunch counters. And they would be in the store over at the cosmetic counter, at the magazine rack or whatever, but they'd keeping an eye on the lunch counter, you see. This is when they found out that we were serious. And so it went off without a hitch. Six different businesses allowed two people to come in. So we didn't want the KKK to know when and where we were going. And so we went the first day at 10 a.m. and the next day at 2 p.m., the next day at 4 p.m.
And hopefully they never caught on.
And they never caught on because the newspaper had even written an article and said if there are any problems, they're probably going to discontinue. So I thought this is counterproductive for the newspaper to write an article like that because if anybody doesn't want it to happen, all they got to do is go down there and start a problem, you know. But they didn't know exactly where to go and when to go.
Dr. Sonny Herford III helped integrate Alabama's public schools in 1963. We'll have more on his story in just a moment. He'll share what it was like for his son to be among the first black children to go to an all-white school in Huntsville, Alabama. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers can be found on our website at WPR.org/newsmakers. You can also like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. We're talking with Dr. Sonny Herford III, who helped lead a movement in the early 1960s to desegregate schools in Huntsville, Alabama. He's been talking about what led up to allowing his son and other black children to attend all-white schools. Even after a successful lawsuit, the children had difficulty getting into the school for the first day of class.
We were supposed to go to the school the day after Labor Day. It was traditional in Huntsville that all the schools, as a matter of fact, in all of the cities in Alabama, the schools would open the day after Labor Day. And so we had won the lawsuit, and the judge had ruled in our favor, and this was the 14th of August of 63. And school board was supposed to admit these four students who had signed the petition. And then we went on that Tuesday morning. And not only could we not get in the school was locked. There was a mob down there at the school, a crowd of about 250 people, maybe 300. And for a while, I had forgotten how the mob treated us. But then a few years ago, when the black legislators were going up the Capitol steps to vote on the president's health care, did you see that?
Yes. Was it
That's
similar?
That's exactly the way they treated us. But I had pushed that in the back of my mind, way back in the back recesses of my mind, because I didn't want to think that anybody would hate me that much. And all of a sudden it came back to me. That's the way they treated us that day. So they called us everything that you can think of, my son and me. They did everything except throw rocks at us. But I understand at another school where a lady took her daughter, they did throw rocks at them. So anyway, we couldn't get in. The school was locked. All right, so that was Tuesday after Labor Day. Wednesday morning, we went back. It was basically the same thing. Then Thursday, we went, and the attorneys for the NAACP had told us that they would also be going back to the judge in Birmingham and see if they could get a restraining order. And they were working with the judge in Birmingham. Then Friday, we went, and not only was the mob there, and the school was locked, as previously they wouldn't let the black student in, they wouldn't let the white students in either. There were 12 highway patrol cars, and each car had two highway patrolmen standing beside it, and they were armed and helmeted. And they would not let us even get close to the school. Now, some of the white citizens told me later on that they had some secret meetings with the governor on the weekend. I don't know if that's true or not. But I know that when we went Monday morning, the school was wide open. No mob, no highway patrolman, or anything. And we walked into the school unobstructed at 8:30 Monday morning, September the 9th, 1963. And that was the first time that black kids and white kids had ever been in the same school in the state of Alabama.
And there's a pretty famous photo of you walking Sonny the Fourth into school. You're dressed up, ready for work. Mm-hmm. He's just an adorable little boy who I don't know if he even knew what was going on at the time.
He didn't. And when they interview him, he always says he didn't know what was going on. And he said he didn't know he was supposed to be afraid. He said, I didn't know much about people then as I know now. And he said, if I had known, I would have been horrified.
So at that moment when you let go of his hand and then you left him at school and you walked out of the school, what was that like for you? What was going through your
head?
When
I went back leaving him in the school? Mm-hmm. Oh, that was pretty rough. I was getting ready to go to my office to see my morning patients because I usually started about 9 o'clock with my morning patients. And it was pretty rough, you know. Matter of fact, there were a whole lot of things that were rough back in those days. I was just thinking the other day about this situation, and I've never presented this in any of my interviews before. But can you imagine this now, not associated with the school situation, but talking about the sitting in and the people getting arrested at the counters? Okay, now, I'm raising two preschool kids, one daughter and one son. And every day, my wife and I tell them that you shouldn't do bad things. People who do bad things have to go to jail. And jail is a terrible place to be. Well, my wife was sitting in at the lunch counter, and she was arrested.
While she was pregnant, I believe I read that.
She was expecting. Then how do you think I could handle this to wake up the next morning and tell my two kids, I have to prepare your breakfast today. Your mother's not here. She's in jail. And all the time we've been telling them that bad people go to jail.
Goodness. Wow.
It's hard to explain that to preschool kids.
Right.
Yeah.
What was the rest of the school year like for Sonny the Fourth?
The very first year, he had a few problems.
With other students or maybe with parents?
From the students. I don't think he had any problem with the parents after that first day. Now, the first day or so, when we were outside and we couldn't get in and those other parents couldn't get in too. And I think they were just as mad that they couldn't get in as they were thinking that we wanted to get in, you see. But then after the kids did get in and they were together, as far as I know, I don't think he had any problem with any of the parents. He did speak of a situation where there was a little girl that they were in the line to get lunch, and there was some trays, and the little girl, as they went down the rail to get to the trays, she couldn't get her tray. She was too short. And so he reached up and got the tray for her, and he went to hand it to her, and he said, she looked me right in the eye, and she said, no, my mama told me never take anything from a nigger.
Mm.
And he said, I knew at that time that she didn't really know what she was saying, that that was her mother speaking through her, you know. And so he forgave her for that because he felt that she was just saying what her mother had told her to say. Then there was another incident where he and a fella, another Caucasian boy, were on the playground, and the boy kept calling him names, and he just ignored him until the guy started throwing dirt on him. And so when he started throwing dirt on him, then they tangled up, and they went to the ground, and they threw dirt on each other. And somebody separated them, took them to the principal's office. And the principal looked on the little white boy, and he looked on him, and he chastised my son because the white boy had more dirt on him than my son did.
And what about—
so he laughs about that nowadays. Yeah. But other than that, I don't think he had any problems. Now, this was a public school, and then when he was in the third grade, he transferred to a Catholic school because his mother's Catholic, and he always wanted to go to Catholic school, and he wanted to go to Notre Dame. And so,
which he ended up doing.
Which he ended up doing. And then in the public school, they liked him so much until he ended up being the president of the Student Government Association.
Was your son, Sonny the Fourth, was he the only African-American student at the Catholic school?
Oh, no. No. As a matter of fact, the Catholic school that he went to, it was the other way around. There were more blacks than there were whites at the Catholic school that he attended.
And what about for you in that first year as a parent? Because obviously education is incredibly important to you and your wife. Were you involved? I mean, how did you feel on a day-to-day basis with Sonny in the school?
Oh, well, what we tried to do, we tried to make it appear to him that everything was just a normal situation.
As any good parent would do.
And now he says it really worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So we, you know, we attended the PTA meetings, you know, and that sort of thing, but we didn't try to make a big to-do out of it.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Sonny Herford III, a civil rights activist who worked to desegregate the schools in Alabama. So, Dr. Herford, actually last September was the 50th anniversary of you and Sonny walking up to the Fifth Avenue School in Huntsville, Alabama. I actually saw some local news footage from last September of the two of you taking that walk again, which was really emotional to watch.
Yes.
I'm just assuming it was an emotional moment for you, too.
I think I realized at the time, you know, what an impact that was on other people.
Sure.
I really didn't. And that afternoon, they unveiled an exhibit at the library showing the four students who integrated the schools, along with some other artifacts from the civil rights movement. And then they had speakers. The superintendent spoke, and the school board president spoke. When I was a youngster, all of the school board members were white male. Now the school board president spoke, and she is a black lady that I delivered.
Really?
And when she got up, she said, first of all, she expressed her appreciation for what we had done to integrate the schools. And she said, we're going to tear down University Place School, and we're going to rebuild it at a new site. And when it goes up, the name that will be on the school will be Dr. S. W. Herford School. Mm-hmm. They named the school after me.
So when you look at everything that's happened over the last 50 years, what more can be done? What more do you want people to think about when it comes to civil rights and education and race relations?
Well, one thing I think that we need to do, we need to try to see if we can get better teachers than we have, or get the teachers to improve themselves by going back taking postgraduate courses. Then we have a tremendous drug problem in the school. We have a gangs problem in the school. And so we need to do more work in that regard.
Over the years, too, you've shared your stories through – you've written a book.
Yes.
You've written a couple books. You've helped
one book.
Okay.
Two movies and one book.
Can you talk about why it was that you decided that you wanted to take on these projects?
On the book situation, there were so many people who had worked so hard to try to get their rights, and their story had never been told, you see. And so I thought it would be worthwhile to write their stories so that the people in the nation and the world would know about these people and how hard they worked and the obstacles that they had to overcome. And also, there was another reason for my writing the book. The medical authorities in Alabama had put out a lot of untrue things about me that were innuendos and untruths and just lies about me, and tried to defame me and my reputation.
Does this go back to your efforts during the civil rights movement?
To my efforts on the civil rights. And so I wanted to try to set the record straight. And so in my book, I tell about these things and how they viewed it and how it really happened.
Because did the state of Alabama take away your medical license?
Yes, yes.
Were you ever able to get it back then?
Beg pardon?
Did you get it back?
No. Huh. I've not had a license since 93.
Wow.
Yeah. So they said that I could get my license back, but the things that they wanted me to do to try to get my license back were just outrageous. They wanted me to take 500 hours of postgraduate work. And so, like, when I was when I finished high school, they said that I had not really learned to be a doctor. And when I was in high school, I graduated as valedictorian. And when I was in college, I didn't have a 1B on my transcript. And when I was in medical school, I graduated number 2 in the class of 65. So I didn't think that I needed to go back to school.
Dr. Herford, why is it important for people to remember all the events and all the work that went into the civil rights movement today?
It's history. We don't want it to die. We want the people to remember the people who worked to try to get things changed and how difficult it was for them to try to get them changed, how dangerous it was for them in that era.
Dr. Sonny Herford III helped integrate all-white schools in Huntsville, Alabama. He shared his civil rights era story during a recent visit to La Crosse. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. And if you'd like to comment on our program or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.